Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s. And each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Welcome to Special Edition, a weekly look at the issues in the news and the personalities shaping the stories. Special Edition is a production of Intercom Communications.
Thanks for tuning in to Special Edition. I'm Paula Degnan, and this week we have a full slate of guests for you. We're going to be hearing from Andrew Campanella. He is the president of National School Choice Week, which will be getting underway January 24th. Susan Weinstock is with AARP. She is the Financial Resilience VP, and she's going to talk about older job seekers. Speaking of money, Mark Stieber is the Chief Tax Information Officer with Jackson Hewitt, and there will be a different tax return experience this year. But we're going to start off with Marcia Ferranto. She is the CEO of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund, and it's the end of the year fatality report. First of all, let's have you give us a little bit of background on the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund.
Sure. So the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund is the leading authority on all law enforcement officers' line of duty fatalities. As an organization, our three pillars are honoring the fallen, telling the story of American law enforcement, and making it safer for those who serve. And today is the day, once a year, we come out with our annual fatality report reflecting the prior year's numbers. And in an effort to let the country know how many law enforcement officers have put their lives on the line to keep us safe, and how many of these law enforcement officers have died as a result.
Marcia, I'm going to let you go right to it then, because I have a feeling that as the years are going by, unfortunately, your numbers are increasing.
So unfortunately, 2020 will go down in history as one of the most deadliest years for American law enforcement. Our numbers have increased 96% from last year. We are currently seeing 264 law enforcement officers who died in the line of duty. 145 of those are related to COVID. Now, understand that the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund, being the leading authority on all line of duty deaths, these cases go through a very stringent review process. So are there more cases that are going to be attributed to COVID? Absolutely. Some of those cases are currently in the pipeline, but because of the numbers, the magnitude, we have put together a task force to focus on these line of duty deaths as they relate to COVID. But not until they get through our review process will we be able to certify that they are actually line of duty death. I think it's important to know that for us to consider a COVID death in law enforcement, it has to be shown that that COVID was contracted through direct exposure while conducting official duties. And so that process takes a while. We're focusing right now on 145 confirmed. We have 48 law enforcement officers who died due to firearms. and that is down 6% from the prior year. And we're looking at 44 law enforcement officers who died in traffic-related incidents, and that's up 2%. To understand where Pennsylvania falls in this, Pennsylvania is looking at 12 officers who died in the line of duty this year. One was due to firearms. One was due to traffic-related causes. 8 were COVID. And then 2 were other. And other usually falls under, say, like a heart attack or some other physical illness that they contracted during the line of duty.
Do you have an idea of where Pennsylvania comes in the list of that?
I do. So if we're looking at the entire nation, 13 states had no fatalities at all.
Not even to COVID?
Texas was our highest, not even to COVID.
Oh.
There was actually 26 states had no COVID deaths. 13 states had no fatalities. But when you look at Texas, Texas had 48 fatalities, 8 firearms, 5 traffic, 2 other, and 33 COVID. Pennsylvania falls, I'm going to say, in the sort of in the middle, leaning towards the high.
How long have you been doing this as far as keeping track of the fatalities?
We've been doing this for about 3 decades.
And have you seen particular highs, lows? Have you been able to take a look at the analysis, perhaps, as to, you know, again, 2020, as you said, has reached a peak here. So have you ever seen that happen before?
We have. I mean, in the history of law enforcement, the early 70s showed high numbers. But other than that, I mean, this is going to far surpass 9/11 of the COVID-related fatalities. But the closest in history that we can go back to these kind of fatalities were in the early 70s, where there was a lot of unrest. But this year will come in as, I think, the most deadliest year for law enforcement.
And you also have a officer's memorial in Washington, D.C., which I found interesting is a walk in the shoes experience. Can you tell us about that?
So, yes, in Washington, we have a law enforcement campus. On one side of the campus, we have our law enforcement officer's memorial, where we engrave all the names of fallen officers that have lost their lives in the line of duty. On the other side of the campus, we have the National Law Enforcement Museum, and that experience is a very interactive experience, walking in the shoes of law enforcement. Currently, it's closed to the public. Although our physical doors are locked, we actually are still doing a lot of programs that I would highly suggest that your listeners log into. If they go into lawmemorial.org, they can actually find this report and all the details. And they can also read about what they can do in their communities to help keep law enforcement safe.
And I was going to ask you that. Is there anything that we can do?
Yes. One of the things that we can be doing around the country that can help with these COVID numbers is to let the dispatcher know when you call 911 exactly what these law enforcement officers are going to face when they get there as it pertains to COVID. If you are aware of a COVID related circumstance within the environment which these law enforcement officers are going to enter, it's imperative that we let the dispatcher know so that the law enforcement officer can be well prepared to enter this environment. You know, unlike us, these law enforcement officers, these first responders, their job requires them to walk head on into these environments. The better prepared we can make them, the safer we can keep them.
And when we're talking about the whole aspect of COVID, and obviously first responders, police officers are now all hopefully being able to get the vaccine. So that's at least one way, but still the public does bear some responsibility, as you just said.
That's right. And hopefully very soon, I know it depends on which state you're in, these first responders are being vaccinated. They have the option of being vaccinated, and hopefully they will be able to do that to keep themselves safe. And we can see this pipeline start slowing down due to COVID-related fatalities.
Marsha, what else would you like our listeners to know about these numbers and the whole concept of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund?
I think, you know, today is a very somber day for us here in Washington as we reflect on the line of duty deaths in 2020. And I think the thing that I would like your listeners to be most aware of, and that is there's men and women all over our country that are waking up every morning, putting their lives on the line to keep us safe. And now with COVID, not only are they putting their lives on the line, but they are also exposing their families and their friends. And we just need to be aware that these men and women are doing this to keep our community safe. And we need to do everything in our power to help keep our law enforcement officers safe.
Thank you, Marcia Ferranto, for joining us today. And thanks to all who serve and keep us safe. Now, Andrew Campanella, he's the president of National School Choice Week and talks about School Choice Week, which begins on January 24th. Andrew, what a topic, because of the fact that we have so many changes in schools and the way that children are going to school. What first ever brought about National School Choice Week?
Well, National School Choice Week was created in 2011 to raise awareness about all the options that families have for their children's education: public, charter, private, magnet, online, and home education. And over the past 10 years, what we have done is provide families with resources and information and hopefully some inspiration when it comes to finding schools that meet their children's needs. We recognize all the options equally, so we're not steering families towards one type of school or away from another. Our goal is to just raise awareness and help families navigate the process of choosing a school for their children, because for too many families, they view this process as stressful and complicated. And so we want to take some of the stress and the complication out of that.
Well, let's get right into what everybody has been introduced to, and that is virtual school, online learning. Can you kind of give us a little bit of a focus on that, because for most people, that was something entirely new.
Right. And so the pandemic yielded some really quick emergency changes to the way education is and was delivered to students in this country. And what happened was schools had to adjust on a dime and determine how would they continue educating students. And they came up with some emergency remote learning systems. Some of these were better than others. And they're not the same as traditional online learning or full-time online schooling, which is a method of education that has been around for more than a decade. And they've gotten really good at best practices, making sure that kids don't have to sit in front of a camera for 6 or 8 hours, making sure they don't have to watch a computer screen for 6 or 8 hours at a time. So yes, this emergency remote learning has caused a lot of frustration among families, and it has fueled a huge interest in school choice. Schools have gotten in some ways better at it over time, but I think everybody's ready to be over with it. And if you want to go to online school, there are those options available. They are set up to do this, and in-person schools, looking forward to go back in person.
And again, when we're talking about the differences, I know a lot of people have mentioned, especially the fact of younger children. So can you give us a little bit of a, you know, again, a lot of this, love those teachers out there. They're really giving it their all, and they're trying their darndest. But so many people have said that for younger children, they need more of the one-on-one contact. So do you find that in, if you were doing it just regular online learning?
Well, with regular full-time online school, these realities, these best practices are all built into the model. So students are learning based on their age, based on their grade level, based on the required involvement from their families. They're going through what has been determined to be an effective education model. It does not include having kids sit and stare at a screen for a full day. I've talked to people who run online schools, and they tell me that that's just bad practice, and it's a demotivator. And so, yeah, you're right. There are better ways of educating younger children that don't include requiring them to just stare at a screen. And you know, I'm not faulting teachers and administrators and school leaders.
Oh, absolutely not. No.
Having to deal with having to deal with a pandemic like this, they've been heroes. Mm-hmm. They have done everything possible to try to help students. This is just a difficult time, not just in education, but across our country for a lot of reasons. And, you know, I think it's important to look forward and make sure that we can, A, help kids learn right now, B, make sure that they don't lose the passion and excitement that comes with learning. They don't look at learning and the acquisition of knowledge as some sort of a bore. And three, make sure, or C, make sure we can make up for the lost learning that happened this year, so that students can be on the right track and continue learning and pursuing their interests.
Well, one of the reasons that I ask that is because I know that there are a lot of students who are benefiting from the opportunity to be learning virtually, not in the classroom. A lot of distractions are taken away from them, but parents are still concerned about that one-on-one kind of relationship that especially younger students may have. So if families are interested, are they able to find out about all of the different options in school choice that are available now, even though they're pretty much doing it everybody the one way?
Sure. So the options that families have in terms of types of schools they can choose for their kids have not changed because of the pandemic, but the pandemic has required the way individual schools deliver education to change. So families should still, if they're interested in finding a new or different learning environment for their children, whether for the remainder of this school year or more likely for the next school year, they should start that process now. And at School Choice Week, we have put together resources for families that are comprehensive and detailed and practical that help you navigate all the different options in your state, step by step, in a jargon-free way. And we also have a new school finder tool called Schools Near Me that we just launched 2 weeks ago. Lets you search for all the different types of schools in your area, visit their websites, and build a list of prospect schools. So we're hopeful that parents will use School Choice Week, as they always have done, to look at their options, to evaluate their options, and to make decisions in advance of next school year. Because if you wait too long, you'll find that you have fewer choices as parents sign their kids up for different schools and those schools become fully enrolled. You start the process now, schools can adjust and they can add more seats.
And where do we find all the information?
Sure, it's at schoolchoiceweek.com. That's schoolchoiceweek.com. Information for families and for educators as well.
And I don't want to run over our time, Andrew, but I just want to get your take on what's been happening and how this may even, as you said, you know, make more room for people. Do you see that as becoming a difference now that people have had to do this? And maybe as the future goes on, they're going to be saying, well, maybe I can choose something else. Has this kind of sparked an interest in that?
It really has. 63% of parents told us in a poll that they're looking for a new school for their child, or they have looked. I thought the number sky high. We ran the poll with a different group of folks. They said the same thing. There's a huge interest in school choice out there. It's not an indictment of any one type of school. It's just the reality that parents are all focusing on education this year at one time. And families are recognizing that even if they really like their child's school, they want options. Because in case something like this pandemic ever happens again, they want to be able to switch. Or they're seeing that, you know, maybe the things their kids are learning don't meet but the family wants. There are so many different reasons why you might choose a different school.
Well, that was, again, that was going to be my next question. And are all these different schools available throughout the U.S.?
Really depends on where you live. So every state has their own school choice policies, and every state provides different opportunities for parents. Some states have open enrollment programs to let you choose public schools outside of your zone or district, charter schools that are free to attend, magnet schools that are free to attend and based on themes, online public schools also free to attend. Some states have programs that provide tuition assistance for private schools in grades K through 12, almost like financial aid. And of course, homeschooling, which is available in all 50 states. So go to our website, schoolchoiceweek.com, and find out the options in your state. There are more options for families today than there ever have been, and now is the time to start the process if you want to make a change for the next school year.
Well, you sound like you're going to be very busy, Andrew, so lots of luck, and hopefully when next year's School Choice Week comes along, you'll have different things to tell us about.
Absolutely. It's going to be an interesting year, and I appreciate the time, and I hope everybody will join us in looking forward and seeing what we can all do to help kids learn and succeed even during a challenging time.
Thanks again to Andrew Campanella for giving us the background on National School Choice Week, which this year begins January 24th. Now, don't go away. We're going to talk with AARP and Jackson Hewitt all about money next on Special Edition. Welcome back to Special Edition. Money, money, money. And guess what? Taxes right around the corner. Mark Stieber with Jackson Hewitt will be here to tell us what's new this year. But we're going to start off by meeting Susan Weinstock. She's the Vice President of Financial Resilience for AARP. Susan is going to tell us about how the pandemic continues to affect older Americans and especially women. Susan, it's right there in your title, finances. Everybody's always concerned about them. So what's happening with finances for those of us who are a little bit on the older side?
Well, what we're really worried about is those who are unemployed and those who are older workers. This pandemic has, you know, we have now a 6.7% unemployment rate, which is almost double what it was pre the pandemic. And then almost half of those who are 55 and older who are unemployed have now been unemployed for, they're called long-term unemployed. That means they've been unemployed for 6 months or more. And that is a long time.
And when we're talking about that, again, we've been hearing, I know here in Pennsylvania, there's been unemployment issues and many people have not received unemployment amounts. So that's even making the situation worse.
Absolutely. And the unemployment rate in Pennsylvania is 1.5% higher than it was back in February. It's at 6.6%. So it's a tough situation for a lot of people. There was the stimulus bill that recently passed that has an extra $300 in unemployment benefits plus the $600 in stimulus payment. So I think those will be the lifeline that people are going to need to get through this pandemic that will be a big help to folks, but very, very difficult.
And when we're talking about unemployment, again, things have changed in many years, and it's not necessarily the male who is the breadwinner of the family, or in some instances, the female is dealing with everything on her own. So does it seem that women are more impacted from what you've been hearing at AARP?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, women are have many, many burdens as part of this pandemic. They're often providing child care to a kid who's on Zoom for school, and they may be caregiving for a loved one, a parent, a spouse, a child also. And then they're trying to hold down a job. So it's really, really been tough. Women 55 and older, their unemployment rate is more than double than it was back in February. And it's just been, it's been very difficult for them to be able to, you know, juggle all of these different parts of their lives and keep a job. So some are just leaving the workforce. Our December unemployment numbers, once you take into account that men actually gained employment, was 140,000 jobs lost by women in this economy. So it's been a really tough road for women.
And aside from being women, also being older workers, how does that affect both men and women with those who have lost their jobs and are finding it now more difficult to get work in the workforce?
Right, exactly. Well, we did research after the Great Recession, and we found that folks who had lost their job in the Great Recession took almost double the time to
to find a new job, as did younger workers. And then even when they did find a new job, they often made less, their salary was less than it had been prior to the recession, prior to them losing their job. So, you know, this is the part of my title about financial resilience. You know, work is the key component of financial resilience. And so it's so important. And we're living longer, we're living healthier. A lot of people, we've done survey research, not only do they work for the money, but they work because it gives them a sense of purpose. It gives them bite-sized social isolation. It, you know, it gives you meaning. They enjoy the work. It's so hard when you lose a job at any age, but particularly if you're an older worker.
So many older workers who have been displaced because of the pandemic are going out and starting new careers, going to places where they have to have sometimes training for things like this. So what can you suggest that might give them a little bit more confidence in going out to some of those situations, because that's tough?
Yes, absolutely. And we actually did survey research that showed that women were finding it more daunting than men to go out and find that new job, just sort of more dreading it. But the thing that would be the most useful at this point, if you're unemployed, is to think about reskilling and upskilling. So contact your local community college. Courses are very affordable. You're of a certain age, they're often free. And you can take a course online. You don't have to leave your house. You maybe be able to get a certificate. This is something that you could add to your resume, add to your LinkedIn profile. It demonstrates that you're a go-getter, that you're always interested in, you know, lifelong learning and in increasing your skill set. And that's an important thing for an employer. And you can put that in your cover letter for a job you're applying for. You know, yes, I'm unemployed, but I've also learned how to do this through online courses because I'm unemployed.
So do you think it's better to have something in mind? Because again, you're going to be putting time into that and hopefully be able to reap something once you get to the other end. Should you look at things and say, well, I think I'd be interested in that, so I need to brush up my skills on that and then come back and then apply?
Sure, that's a great way to do it. There's also career counselors at local community colleges that can help pick the courses that you might need. And you can look around and use LinkedIn to look at what, if there's a field you want to go into, see if you can find people in that field that you might be able to talk to and look at their career trajectories and see what sort of certificates and information they provide. That might give you a good flow to see what might work for you.
It's a whole new world when you think about where many of us came from when we were first starting out, and now we have technology to contend with and so many other things. Are there other resources, Susan, that we might be able to tell our listeners that, you know, the ones that you gave so far are great, but would there be any more that they can use? Because the more help they can get, the better.
Absolutely, yes. So we have an online career fair that's coming up on January the 28th from 1 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. This will be an opportunity to network. There'll be employers that'll be participating. We'll have webinars about building your LinkedIn profile, other information. So that should be very useful. So go to aarp.org/onlinecareerexpo to register for that. And then if you go to aarp.org/work, we have a job board that has jobs posted from employers who are interested in hiring older workers. We also have a resume tool where you can get a free critique of your resume. And then we have a lot of content about industries that are hiring, jobs, work-from-home jobs, part-time jobs, that sort of thing that will be very useful to people.
Oh, Susan, please give us that information one more time. The where, the when, and how we, that's awesome. Woo! Didn't know about that one.
Oh, good. Well, I'm happy to provide that information. So the expo, the online career expo is Thursday, January 28th from 1 to 4 p.m. And the to register, go to aarp.org/onlinecareerexpo. And then aarp.org/work is where you'll find our job board, our our resume tool and all of the content that I mentioned.
Well, I certainly hope that you'll come back and visit with us again, because let us know how all that turns out. That is a wonderful resource. Thank you, Susan. What a great way to start the day today by learning something new from you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. You take care, okay?
Okay. Thank you, Susan. We'll talk to you again.
All right.
Thanks again to Susan Weinstock, the Vice President of Financial Resilience for AARP. Mark your calendar for January 28th. You'll find the link on the AARP website from 1 until 4, a job fair, and find out what's out there. Now, of course, speaking of dates, the tax date will be coming up soon. Mark Stieber is here. He's the Chief Tax Information Officer at Jackson Hewitt and says returns will be different this year.
Well, 2020 will be one for the yearbooks, both for the year that was the pandemic year and now the wrap up with the individual income tax return that will be reflective of 2020. You know, there were so many changes for most Americans, it'll be hard to see that there'll be anybody not touched, whether it's folks who got the first or the second stimulus payment, whether it's any of the 60 million Americans who filed for unemployment at some portion, you know, 40 million Americans who started or kept going with their self-employed or part-time gig business. There were tax law changes that go even farther than that. And then there's all the rest of life that people have every year, even, absent a pandemic, getting married, getting divorced, having a child, adopting a child. All of those will go on to your tax return and in many cases create a bigger benefit. So there's a lot to watch for this year in the way of opportunity. But with that goes the opportunity of risk. If you leave something off of your tax return in the way of a benefit, a deduction, a credit, some of that stimulus money that you may still be due, that will generally stay off of your tax return just like every year. The IRS is not in the business of making sure you get the biggest refund. They're in the business of making sure you pay your taxes. It's on you to make sure you get the biggest refund. So it'll be very important for folks to watch for all the things that happened in their lives, all the things that happened in the tax world, the tax law changes, and then marry the two up by using a trained, experienced, and qualified pro to make sure they get the biggest refund they can.
Let's talk a little bit about that stimulus money. What is the deal with that? Are we paying it back, part of it back? Have we been taxed on it? How does all that work?
The stimulus payment programs were both very, very generous, depending on your political affiliation. But I will say it this way. The first one, $1,200 per person. The second one going on right now, even as we speak, about $600 per person, including dependents. The IRS did their best effort on the first one and on the second one. But that doesn't mean that everyone gets all of their money. Yeah, and even by no fault of the IRS or their own, lives change. People have children, and they didn't have that on the initial payment, that is to say, on the automatic payment relying on prior data. So you may have a life change that had a child. You may do more money. There was a law change on the most recent bill that said some people can go back and get extra money that didn't get it the first time. And so there's a lot of moving parts on the stimulus payment, but the simplest answer is it's not taxable. But the downside is you might not have gotten all of your money, and you'll need to reconcile that on your 2020 tax return. Tell your tax pro all about your situation, your life, your family makeup, how much money you got, and you maybe do more money. And if you accidentally got too much money, say they gave you money for a dependent that's no longer yours but went over to a shared custody spouse, you don't even have to pay that money back. So it's kind of a win-win. So it's in your best interest to make sure you talk with your tax pro and tell them all your situational facts and get the biggest money you can. But the stimulus payment programs going on now, the one back in February kind of wrapping up, but you reconcile it on your 2020 tax return right now to make sure you get all of it. And if you do more, you get more.
So as far as anything that we have usually been dealing with, and I know a lot of people are going to have questions on unemployment, because again, that kind of goes with the stimulus. Some got some didn't. So where does all that go?
Yeah, unemployment benefits have been very complex this year. And unemployment benefits are one of the trickier areas on a tax return in a regular year, let alone the 2020 pandemic year. Many people think unemployment benefits are not taxable, when in fact, just like regular earnings or regular wages, unemployment benefits are fully taxable. For 2020, though, you saw regular benefits. Most states, if not all, had expanded their benefit program. They've extended it in many cases. The federal government added on their own federal unemployment program, which many states enacted on. So you may receive one, two, three, or more statements this year outlining your unemployment benefits. And it's important that you put those on your tax return, because if you leave it off, I promise you, Uncle Sam and the government will know about it, and you'll get one of those nasty letters, probably a tax assessment, penalty, and interest. Yeah, the other thing about unemployment benefits that catches people off guard are two things. The first is, unlike wages, unemployment benefits do not automatically have withholdings, tax withholdings as a part of them. You must opt in. You must ask for taxes to be withheld. And most people in their, you know, concern over unemployment and being out of work don't ask for less money and more taxes to be withheld. So many people are caught off guard at tax time. First, that it's taxable, and two, you didn't prepay any taxes like you did with your wages. So that really catches people off guard, kind of a surprise. Another thing to be sure to share with your tax pro, that you had unemployment benefits and that you have the totality of the payment, you know, statements that should be coming in the mail, but not every time. Some states are now going to virtual, like your computer, and you have to go and download your statement. But leave it off. I promise you, the IRS will know, and you'll get a letter.
Oh, man, there's an awful lot to be thinking about. So is there anything that I don't even know how to phrase it to look forward to?
Well, I will say this, 3 out of 4 taxpayers do get a refund every year. We don't see that being different this year. Perhaps some refund shock if you don't catch all the benefits that you have. I'll give you a for example. This year, much like many years, about 27 million people take advantage of EITC. It's a program worth up to $6,600. Well, your income might be less this year because of COVID and you might have been laid off. Well, the last minute law change said, hey, if your income was less, you can look at last year's tax return, 2019's tax return, and cherry pick the better of the two incomes. Pick the bigger for the EITC. Overlook that, you might get less EITC. If your pro knows about that rule and you tell them, you know, I think I get EITC, you can get the better of the two and probably get a bigger refund. So there's lots of those little tidbits in the tax bills that were passed, as the CARES Act, the provision at the end of the year, and even the Tax Cut and Job Act to watch for. So most taxpayers should be okay to even better, but you know, there's a lot of places to look, as I started off at the beginning, and you don't want to miss something that you're due.
Mark, you're awesome. I wish we could have more time with you. So sharpen your pencils and get us through it.
Well, you know, if you need more information, JacksonHewitt.com, all this, videos of me, videos of us, you know, telling you about this, an easy way to jumpstart your interest in the tax season this year. Plus, you can get started and find an office. Just put your zip code in.
Great information there from Mark Stieber, the Chief Information Officer at Jackson Hewitt. Now, don't go away. When we come back, January is Radon Awareness Month, next on Special Edition. Thanks for tuning in to Special Edition. This time, we introduce you to Kevin Stewart. He is the Director of Environmental Health, Advocacy, and Public Policy for the American Lung Association. He is here to talk about radon awareness. You can't see it, you can't taste it, you can't even smell it, but it is one of the leading causes of lung disease throughout the country. Kevin is going to give us some insight into how we'd be able to find it in our homes and where we can get that information from their website.
Radon is a naturally occurring, invisible, colorless, odorless, but radioactive gas. It comes out of the ground, and normally in outdoor air, it's quickly diluted. But sometimes in buildings and homes, especially where people spend a lot of time, radon levels can become quite high. And while you can't see it, the exposure to those high levels of radon over time can cause lung cancer. The U.S. Surgeon General has advised everyone to test their home for radon. And in fact, radon ranks as the nation's second leading cause of lung cancer and causing about 21,000 deaths every year in the United States. So the Lung Association is very interested in helping people understand what radon is and making sure that they understand how to test for it and get the problem fixed so that they can save their lives. We view that our job won't be done until the world is free of lung disease.
Wouldn't that be wonderful? One of the things that the American Lung Association has done is the myths that surround radon. Mm-hmm. Since you mentioned the fact that radon is invisible, then I would think that it doesn't really hurt.
If radon was a purple gas and it smelled like
rotten eggs
or something like that, people would pay a lot more attention to it. Unfortunately, really isn't detectable by the senses and doesn't even cause immediate health effects. So it's not like people will develop a sudden cough just on brief exposure. It's only after long periods of exposure, typically years or decades, that people get lung cancer from radon. But that's why we're trying to help people understand about this risk so that they can protect themselves earlier.
Then if it takes so long, it must be a pretty rare occurrence that radon would have anything to do with lung cancer, and it's probably not even in that many homes.
Unfortunately, radon is not only causing thousands of lung cancer deaths every year in the United States, but it also is present in many, many homes. In fact, in Pennsylvania, about 40% of homes have high levels of radon. Pennsylvania is one of the worst states in the country for radon. Your home can have high levels, even if your neighbor's home doesn't. It really doesn't matter what part of the country you're in, but in the northeastern part of Pennsylvania, nearly all of the counties there are regarded as having levels with the highest frequency of radon in homes, according to the EPA's map. I mean, you know, almost all the counties are shaded in red on EPA's zone map, and that's a sign that not only is radon fairly common, it is especially common at high levels in that part of Pennsylvania.
And you wouldn't even know it.
That's correct. Radon can come in all the time. No home is immune in the sense that if it's in contact with the soil in any way, it will come in through cracks in walls, basement floors, or even homes that are built slab on grade. It can come in through the foundation and other openings and be present at dangerous levels indoors, even if your house is wonderfully appointed and would be in better homes and gardens.
It's another one of those things that does not discriminate.
Correct. Absolutely.
Let's talk about testing now. Are they to be trusted? And if not, would testing for radon be expensive?
There is a rigorous program in place in Pennsylvania to make sure that the tests that are offered to the public do need to pass certain standards of practice so that the laboratories that are involved with doing the analysis are following national consensus standards that require them to meet very rigorous requirements as far as accuracy and precision and reliability. So that's one thing, and I want to assure people about the reliability of the testing. The other thing is that testing really is easy to do, and they're inexpensive. There are lots of test kits that are do-it-yourself test kits that are simple to use. Many of them are available in hardware stores, department stores, or online from the laboratories. I want to emphasize that the only way to detect radon levels in the home is to test the air. You do need this kind of test in order to understand it. It's not going to be something that you're going to be able to smell or taste or anything. In fact, though, I do want to point out the Lung Association is currently offering, certainly during National Radon Action Month, free radon test kits. And then that's for a limited time while supplies last. And it is for Pennsylvania residents only. We request that the request be limited to one per household because we don't have enough to go around for even everybody at that rate, but we do have this limited supply. There is a website that we want people to go to if they're interested in the tests. It is www.lungradonkits.org/PA, and that's Lung Radon Kits, all strung together, no spaces. LungRadonKits.org/PA. And if people go to that website, but I want people to understand that if they're concerned about radon, and they properly should be, we want to provide this opportunity for people to do some testing.
What happens if the test comes back positive?
Well, it's important to understand that there are various costs involved that are relatively small. Fixing radon problems in most homes will cost in the $500 to $1,500 range in Pennsylvania. It does depend a lot on whether there is any preemptive radon work that was done in a house that would then allow for easy connection of a fan and activation to get that soil gas eliminated out of the subslab area of the building. Some houses do require more work if there's nothing that's been done in advance. The price ranges are typically, you know, roughly around the price of a new television set or a computer. And we think that for peace of mind and helping to reduce the risk of lung cancer, that is a reasonable price along the line of lots of other expenses that people are quite willing to bear when they're furnishing their homes and so on. And that's something we want to emphasize.
One of the good things that we can also look at our myth list and find out that places like schools are safe.
And in many cases, we have found that there is a lot of leadership that school district authorities have taken to get their buildings tested on a regular basis, to identify where rooms are high in radon, and to get those fixed. And so we want to applaud the schools and the school districts that have done that. In fact, the Lung Association is involved in helping to train school facilities professionals in terms of how to test their own buildings, and even have provided and continue and are willing to continue to do this, to provide some supply of free radon test kits to schools to help them start on that road. We do strongly encourage school districts not to put their head in the sand about this issue, but rather to face it like responsible folks and understand what the risk is, do some testing, do some fixing. It's quite able to be managed. And the Lung Association's offering some help to help schools lower some of the costs by helping to train staff and helping them to by providing the free test kits. As a general rule, we want schools and daycares too, to consider using professional help to do testing. And we do have the professional and approved training program, but at the same time, there's nothing wrong with school districts doing this on their own as well with that professional advice.
And speaking of students, I happened to come across the Department of Environmental Protection here in Pennsylvania had a contest for students to mm-hmm. make posters. And
absolutely,
fortunately, we didn't have any who won here in Northeast Pennsylvania. It was Mifflin County, Somerset County, and Delaware County. But congratulations to them.
Different states will submit their entries for judging, and then the best posters get sent to a national competition. I have a mouse pad that has a radon poster on it that some student had done several years ago. So it gives you an idea that this is a way to get the word out, which is one reason why we do have our program at lungradonkits.org/PA to help people out. It is National Radon Action Month, and every year the Lung Association does point out the fact that radon is the second leading cause of lung cancer in the United States. It is a preventable cause of lung cancer. We have two things that I'd like to point out to you. One, of course, would be that people can obtain limited supply, one test kit per household in Pennsylvania at our website. That is www.lungradonkits.org/PA. And if people are interested in doing a short course to learn more about radon at our National American Lung Association website, at lung.org/radon-basics. People can go there and they can register and study a lot about radon, learn a lot more than we've had the opportunity to talk about today. So I did want people to be aware of that as well.
The American Lung Association has other topics that we'll be featuring here on Special Edition. I'm Paula Degnan. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for listening to Special Edition, a weekly look at the issues in the news and the personalities shaping the stories, a production of Intercom Communications.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly!